Hi, you're listening to a Pod for Good Media Network podcast. We are a network that provides podcasting production services and a supportive community in which podcasters can thrive. If you're a podcaster local in the Tulsa area, we would love to have your show on the network. If you are interested in starting one, we would love to help you get started. Find us online at podforgoodmedia.com and fill out our Pod With Us form. Happy podcasting.
Welcome back to another episode of In Depth with Dion. In this episode, I speak with Imani Myers, a community changemaker, entrepreneur, survivor of the foster care system, and Tulsa Remote participant to learn how she broke in and built community authentically. But first, the rundown. In local Tulsa news, Housing Partnership Network in the city of Tulsa unveiled a plan to expand affordable housing in the city and create pathways to home ownership. In Oklahoma news, the state was the last in the nation to execute a human being just a week before Christmas. It comes as some lawmakers plan to revive efforts to place a moratorium on executions or a pause on executions in Oklahoma during this legislative session. And in national news, a new study from the Charity Reform Initiative of the Institute for Policy Studies, say that five times fast, shows a large percentage of charitable donations are being hoarded by wealth management funds and private foundations for profitable tax benefits. And those are some of the headlines. This is In Depth with Dion. I'm your host, Dion Osborne, recording from Tulsa's historic Greenwood District. Imani Myers isn't just a visitor to Tulsa. She's a change agent. As a participant in Tulsa Remote, she's leveraged her time here to foster authentic connections and uplift marginalized voices, all while building her own brand as an entrepreneur. Imani, I'm so grateful to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm just as grateful. So thank you.
How does it feel? You know, you're coming on the 3-year anniversary of being a Tulsa Remote participant. I just want to give you a chance for right off the bat, like, how are you feeling right now?
Yeah, honestly, it feels wild. You know, I think when you first think about moving to a place, you think about, man, how am I going to be able to stay there for a year? Then you think about you hit the 3-year mark, and I'm like, wow, not only have I survived, but I thrived here. And it's been incredibly amazing.
Well, your actions speak for themselves. You know, you've launched a book. You are the prize. You've launched an app.
Working on it.
Working on the app. Yes. Okay. So I want to get into all this, but first I want to get to what it was like when you initially got here. So tell me, first of all, how did you hear about Tulsa Remote and how did you decide, you know what, I'm gonna make the move?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So first of all, I thought that California would be my home for a really long time. Mm-hmm. And got there and got my very first apartment. And as you know, that's a really big deal for somebody that grew up in foster care. Mm-hmm. And so for me, I was like, you know what? I found home. I'm here. But each year, I found myself still feeling like I wanted to be here. But I remember at the 4-year mark, I said, you know what? I think I'm ready for a move. I'm ready for a change. But I don't necessarily know what that looks like, what that feels like. Mm-hmm. And it was actually through the height of the pandemic, I ended up calling my former supervisor at a program that I used to be a part of. And I was just chopping it up with her, just seeing how she was doing. And she was saying to me, she said, Imani, I'm moving back home. And I said, where's home? She said, Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I was like, really? She said, yes, there is a program called Tulsa Remote, and they will pay you $10,000 to move to the city for a year. And so for me, of course, that piqued my interest as somebody that's, you know, an entrepreneur trying to figure it out and looking for like a new place to call home. And so I was like, you know what, let me look it up. Let me see what it's like. I wasn't quite sure, but I said, you know what, let me apply. That's the very thing that I always say. Let me just apply and see what happens.
Fair enough.
And I applied and I got accepted and I made my way to Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Wow. So, born in Boston.
Yes, born and raised.
Tell me about, you did not have an easy upbringing.
Yeah, not at all.
Tell me how you got to become the person you are today and the things that the struggles you went through in your childhood to get here.
Yeah, no, I appreciate you asking that. First of all, I want to give all credit to my great aunt. God rest her soul. She took my siblings in when I was 6 months old and kept us until I was the age of 10. And one of the things that she strongly emphasized was the importance of gratitude, the importance of helping other people, the importance of having manners, and always reminded me that I didn't have to let my past determine my future. Mm. And so even though I was not raised by my parents, even though they were both struggling with substance use, they were in and out of jail, she always reminded me that I could choose a better life. And at the time, you know, as you're growing up, you don't necessarily believe that, but you're hoping to believe it and you're hoping to see it. Mm. And so, you know, throughout my childhood, as I was in her care, after leaving her care and moving with my mom and being with my mom for a short 2 years and experiencing the abuse that I experienced, having to go into foster care and being separated by my siblings, what I didn't realize was that was one of the toughest things that I had to experience because, as you can imagine, your siblings are your very best friends. They're your first best friends. Mm-hmm. And so we made a pact to stay together forever. And so to have that be taken away from us, right up from under us and not even knowing, you kind of just have to proceed. And so moving into foster care and moving into different homes, being separated from my sister, being separated from my brother, being separated from my mom, you know, one of the things that you always ask yourself is, who are you? Mm-hmm. And I remember at the age of 12, when I walked into my foster mother's bedroom and I had tears in my eyes and I said, why did God create me? I didn't understand it. And he said, Imani, God has a purpose for your life. You may not understand it now, but you'll be able to see it. And so what I like to say is that Tulsa has become the full circle moment for me to be able to see that and to experience that. Because while Boston has been home, while other places have been home, I feel like Tulsa has felt like the most home for me because of the people, because of the energy, because of the history of struggle, the history of survival, the history of even thriving in the midst of all that. And so for me, I was very, very determined from a little kid. I always said that I wanted to write a different story than the one that was written about me. I was determined to make it out. And I was going to do anything that I needed to do to be able to do that. And so with the help of mentors, with the help of people who believed in me, that's one of the reasons why I'm here today.
I feel like you have such a powerful testimony because, you know, I will never say I can understand what you went through or I can relate to what you went through because I didn't go through it myself. But I can empathize with what you went through. One thing I'm grateful for is having spent time working at a Tulsa Youth Services in the emergency shelter for 3 years and getting to get to know some of the strongest people in this world who just happen to be youth in the foster care system, right?
Absolutely. I'll say that we're superheroes.
Yeah. I mean, I've seen, they've helped me learn my own strength by just by watching how they navigate life with next to no resources, next to no support system, but having that internal determination to, I'm going to make a way out of no way. And I feel like that's exactly what you've done here in Tulsa. I want to talk about your book.
Absolutely.
You Are the Prize.
Yes.
Tell me what inspired that and what you hope people reading get out of that.
Yeah, absolutely. So in 2017, I lost my very best friend and sister to suicide. And that was one of the hardest things that I had ever had to experience or go through. As I said to you, that, you know, we made a pact when we were kids. Mm-hmm. And so we talked about growing up together. We talked about raising kids together. And so one of the things that I didn't realize was that I lost my sister before she passed away. I lost her when she went into foster care. Mm-hmm. And so what I mean by that is you lose those memories. You lose those feelings. Actually, you don't lose those feelings, but you lose the feelings that you thought that you would be able to have, the memories that you thought you would be able to have. And so one of the things that really inspired the book was actually my little sister, because one of the things that she said to me before she passed away was, sis, always remember that you are the prize. And when she said it to me, I remember when she said it to me, I like clung onto it like glue, because I knew that her words then were very, very powerful. And when she passed away, I said, you know what? I want to turn her words into something that's going to create legacy, that's going to create inspiration and motivation. Because sadly, while she wasn't always able to see herself as the prize, I wanted to ensure that other people could see themselves as the prize. Mm-hmm. Despite the traumas, despite the pain, despite anything that they've gone through. And so that was really what inspired my book. But the other thing was I also got involved in speaking, you know, with advocacy. And I remember being in places that I never thought I would ever be in, sharing my testimony, sharing my story. And every time at the end, somebody would come up to me and they would say, Imani, when are you going to write your book? When are you going to write your book? And for me, it was something that I've always wanted to do. I actually started writing my book at the age of 12 when I first went into foster care.
Wow.
Yeah, I actually saw and experienced my first Black therapist. She was a woman. Hmm. And I remember going into her office. And one of the things she said to me was like, you know, what is something that you, you know, you're passionate about? What is something that you want to do? And I told her I wanted to write a book. And then very next session, she brought a notebook and a pen. And I started to write. And I quickly became overwhelmed by the details just at the age of 12. And so I think that memory of writing scared me. But when my sister passed away, I said that I had to find something to hold on to. And because I already knew that I was a great writer, I knew that I was somebody that felt my emotions and I could be in tune with my emotions. I wanted to write something that was not only going to help me through my own grief or through my own trauma, but I really wanted to help other young people that have gone through the foster care system that don't even fully know their stories, that I have not been able to hear their stories. Because that's another thing that you that happens in foster care. A lot of times you don't even know why you're in foster care. And so I really wanted to highlight the importance of sharing who you are in the midst of you being silenced. And so that was really the crux of why I wanted to write this book and to really, really challenge the system to think about how their policies, how their procedures, how oppression, racism, how all of that contributes to us being in the system when the system was created as a temporary means that has become a permanent fixture. And when you build something that's temporary, that you plan for it to be temporary, but it becomes a permanent fixture, what happens on the inside? It collapses. And so what I wanted to do was I wanted to be a part of the rebuild of the foster care system as somebody that has lived through the system and someone that is an advocate for the system and for people that are a part of it.
You're making me think of a couple memories I had when I was working at Youth Services, and I wish I would have had your book, and I wish that more organizations will, I hope, implement the app that you're working on, the tools you're creating to help, you know, youth transition out of it. Because one example I'll give, we'll call him AJ.
Yeah.
He was 17, a Black kid. And the only reason he was at that shelter was because DHS decided that his grandma had too many kids living at her house and the oldest kid needed to go. And so he was separated from his entire family, taken to a different state. And it's 11 o'clock at night and the staff is telling him it's time to go to bed. But he doesn't want to go to bed. He's sitting out in the living, you know, in the living area, just refusing to listen to the staff. And ultimately, we had a our supervisor who was a Black woman from Baltimore who was really trained in trauma response and therapy and understood how to talk to these kids, sit down and try to seek to understand what's wrong.
Absolutely.
But the entire approach from the rest of us staff, including myself, was what do we got to do to make him listen? Instead of what do we got to do to make ourselves understand?
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to talk about your app.
Yeah.
Tell me about what you're working on and what you hope that it can do.
Absolutely. So Launch Ahead is a digital platform that is going to support child welfare agencies in supporting young people transition out of foster care. Mm-hmm. And so to give you an idea of what typically happens and what's supposed to happen. So by law, every young person is supposed to begin working on their transition care plan beginning at the age of 14.
Oh.
Absolutely, right? Yes. And what typically happens is that, and what has happened in the past, is that depending on the states, there are some child welfare agencies that begin working with them 6 months before they age out of foster care, which is before they turn 18, or 3 months. And so when I came here to Oklahoma, you know, I've lived in a lot of different states. And whatever state I go to serve. And so I've done a lot of advocacy work in different states. And I do national advocacy work. And so coming here to Oklahoma and getting more direct and getting right in front of the problem, one of the things that I learned was that a lot of young people were transitioning out of care into homelessness. And, you know, one of the things that I had to be appreciative of, and that's the beauty of being able to go and see and do, because when I thought about how I aged out of foster care, you know, I was contacted by my social worker, and she told me that my foster mom was no longer being paid to take care of me. Therefore, I needed to grab my stuff and I needed to leave. Now, I was at a program. I was not eligible to go directly to college because my GPA was not up there at all. Mm-hmm. I barely made it into college. And so I had to do a bridge program. And so as you can imagine, the bridge program was really strict. You had a curfew. And I also lived about an hour away from where I was actually staying, because I was staying on campus. Mm. And so to get that phone call, as somebody that was not, I never was one to run away. I feared independence. But to get that phone call and to tell me that my foster mom was no longer being paid to take care of me, and then to go and to get my belongings and to find them already packed up in black trash bags and a few of my suitcases, and they were waiting for me on the porch, that was devastating. You know, it felt really, really inhumane. And so I stayed stuck to that. But one of the things that I began to look at when I came here was that, wow, I'm so thankful that I had the opportunity to go to college and that I was in college. And while I did not necessarily have a permanent place to stay, one, I was very grateful that I had my college campus. And then luckily, my aunt stepped up and said, you could stay with me. The thing that bothered me the most was I didn't have choice. And so because I didn't have choice, I didn't get to decide where I wanted to go. Because I may have made a different offer, you know, mm-hmm. if I would have been asked. And so to answer your question about that app, the whole premise of that app is to put agency and choice back into the hands mm-hmm. of young people. Because a lot of times what happens is, you know, a social worker might be sitting across from you and just writing out what you're doing, what you think you might be doing. But what's the practicality behind it? And so essentially what I would really want and what I really hope and strive for is that we're actually going to take a full assessment of the young person. And not just any old assessment, but assessing what are their skills, what are their talents, and what's their age? And how can we actually start working with them at 14? And as they take that personalized assessment, as it captures their age, their talents, and their skills, it's going to provide a roadmap, suggested roadmaps that they can take. So for example, Dion, if you were interested in culinary school, but you were interested in cooking, but you didn't know that culinary school existed, mm-hmm. or you were interested in doing things with your hands, and you didn't necessarily know that you could also cut hair. What we want is that the roadmap would push out and present to them options that they may not have been aware of,
yeah.
and things that they can actually work towards, and to guide them from A to Z through that journey. And also with the help and the support of the people that are in their lives. So for example, A caseworker has a job. A judge has a job. A CASA worker has a job. A teacher has a job. And mentors have a job. And sometimes when we all have jobs, sometimes we get tired. So what would it look like if we all came together collectively and said, hey, I see that Dion's social worker is out today, and we know that Dion needs an ID in order to be able to transition out of care successfully. I see that she's out on bereavement. The judge steps in and moves that process along versus waiting. When you wait, you can wait, especially if it doesn't impact you. But if it impacts you, if it makes you to move, it's going to inspire a young person to be able to also take that agency into their own hands. Well, so that's essentially a part of the app that we're working on building. And what I would really want is for child welfare agencies to implement this. And it brings me back, actually, you know, when I was on Capitol Hill and I had an opportunity to write a policy report, and I thought about what it was that I wanted to change about the system. And I talked about, what can we do to train caregivers? What can we do to train foster parents in trauma-informed care training so that when young people come into the system, because when young people come into the system, even just by you removing them from their homes, they are traumatized. And even when you bring them into a home, it doesn't matter how good the home is. The young person is still going to be traumatized. And if you already have secondary trauma or even firsthand trauma from your own stuff, and you're bringing that onto the kids because you have not had the opportunity to be able to work through your own trauma. If we can guide and have support systems for foster parents and caregivers to be able to do that, that then also puts agency into the young person's hands. And so I remember when I had the opportunity to present that report to members of Congress and the White House Domestic Policy Council, and it got taken up by draft legislation by a senator. To me, this app comes full circle, because what I wanted to do was to standardize trauma-informed care training across states, because you wouldn't even believe how many hours of training some foster parents get, and some of it is not even in trauma-informed care training. So are we being preventative? Are we being proactive? And are we looking ahead? Because I'm a product of the crack epidemic. And what you see today are the remnants of what people are still struggling with from that pandemic and from that era, because there weren't things that were put in place like trauma-informed care training. So if we can think 20 years ahead, how technology is going to evolve, do you want to be ahead of the game or do you want to be behind the curve?
Wow.
And so my goal and my hope is that Launch Ahead is going to be ahead of the game.
It's a game changer. We had kids here in Tulsa who didn't start their transition plans until 3 to 6 months before they were 18. You know, there's wait lists for a lot of these kids to even get apartments.
Yeah.
The little that we have available, you know. And so I think your plans combined with the efforts to, you know, expand affordable housing in places like Tulsa could really be a game changer. And I would love to see even, you know, the newly elected mayor, Monroe Nichols, see what his administration can do to help implement this on a local level.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I feel like that would absolutely be a dream. And it's about us doing it together. You know what I'm saying? Like, all of us have a stake in this to make sure that every young person has the opportunity to succeed, because that's our future generation and our current generation, you know? And so I really do want to be able to connect with local organizations here in Tulsa that would be interested in something like this, where we can come together and collaboratively really rethink foster care. And I actually had an opportunity last week with an organization. It's called Foster Hive, group of high school students. And their goal and their mission, actually, Mayor Monroe had the opportunity to actually speak. And they decided to focus their project on young people transitioning out of foster care. And what they hope to do is to bring together a collaborative of people for us to be able to work on this together. Mm-hmm. Because the reality of it is that young people in foster care, they touch every system. They touch the criminal justice system. They touch the mental health system. They touch homelessness. They touch incarceration. And believe it or not, they also touch trafficking. Mm-hmm. And so if we're able to come together to think about how can we solve this problem through an innovative, creative, and collaborative way, not only is that going to help change the narrative for young people in foster care, but it's going to change the narrative for young people in general. Mm-hmm. If you think about the civil rights movement, right? And you think about the laws that have been put in place and who have those greatly impacted and benefited, who has benefited from those? We all have to some degree, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And so if we can think about it as who are the least of these and build from that place, I think that we would be in a much better place.
I hear you and I agree. And I wanted to hear you talk a little bit about how you got to this point when it comes to the incubators and different organizations you've been involved with to grow your business. And so I know that you were at the Black Venture Summit recently, right?
Yeah.
And you got to kind of showcase.
I did.
Right?
Yeah, which was also another thing that I never, ever even imagined. And here I am. And, you know, I think, Dion, it's the power of showing up. Mm. You know, and I have been fortunate enough to be able to show up. And even if I have not always wanted to show up, because there have been times where I have not wanted to show up, there have been plenty of times where I have got denied from certain situations and certain things, and I've still showed up. And because I've showed up, that is how I've been able to get in the door. Mm. And so for me, you know, before I even moved here, actually, like I said, my former supervisor, shout out to Allison, she had told me about Mortar, the program, which is through TEDC. And it's a program for starting budding entrepreneurs. And, you know, I looked into it. But what I said was when I came to Tulsa, I didn't really want to commit to anything in the first year. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to commit to in the first year was building community and being in community. So that was the first step that I took when I first got here, was just to be in community. And also to launch my book. And so it was through me launching my book that my book got showcased at a female founders pitch night. And I remember as they were showcasing my book, Ashley Sims turned around and said, "You really need to build an app. You need to build an app." And it's funny because I had always wanted to get involved in tech some way, somehow. But because I'm not really a tech person, I wasn't sure how that would be possible. Mm. And the beauty of Tulsa is that you don't have to have it all together. You don't have to be perfect. All you have to do is show up and be ready to build. And so it was that opportunity. In addition to Act House, they had a 24-hour hackathon. And they do it, I believe, like four times a year. I'm sure they have one coming up before the end of the year. And I remember I felt anxious. I felt intimidated because I didn't necessarily know what to expect. But the inner child in me was super excited about showing up because it was a lock-in. It was 24 hours. And as somebody that grew up in foster care, I was not allowed to have sleepovers. I was not allowed to sleep over at people's houses, and people were not allowed to sleep over at my house. And so that's something that's so normal, right? That a lot of us don't get to have. So as an adult...
Yeah, I never thought about that.
Right. So as an adult, I'm healing my inner child. Mm. And so I just showed up. And I remember joining somebody on their venture, and their idea got picked. And so we decided to like go with it. And part of it was because I was too afraid to go up there and share my own idea. But part of it was because I didn't necessarily know what I wanted to share. Mm. I didn't necessarily know if I wanted to go the app route, if I wanted to go the book route. And it was through me showing up the next time as well and, you know, pitching and taking home first place. And that was really, really powerful because I just showed up. And I'm going to be real honest with you. That weekend was Very brutal. I ended up losing my tooth. Yeah. Yes.
Well, you had like a bad steak or something?
Nah, actually, the dentist told me I would lose my tooth when I got older because of trauma.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, and it so happened that it fell out on Juneteenth.
What?
Yes. And that same week was the 24-hour build day. And I was trying to decide if I was going to show up because of that.
Yeah.
And I still showed up. And I didn't tell anybody about that situation. You know, my partner at the time knew, but nobody else knew. And just being showing up, even just in the midst of that, that was hard. But by doing so, not only did I get support, but I was able to also take home the prize and involve other people in that process, you know? And so I think the beauty of being able to have access to opportunity is also how do you open the door for others to have opportunity, to gain opportunity? How do you let others in? And I think that is also the next question, you know? Because people think that you have to be the smartest person in the room. People sometimes think that you have to have it all together. And sometimes really what it is being at the right place at the right time. And I've been able to have many of those instances in my life where I have experienced that. And so because of that, it allows me to feel freer in the way that I can give, you know? And if people have not had opportunity to experience that, it can be really difficult.
You know, I remember the first time I met you. You know, we were at a Black Queer Tulsa, like, Sunday brunch.
Yes.
I think it was.
Yes.
And I don't know if you knew, but, like, I had only gone to a few of those myself.
Yeah, I had never seen you before.
Yeah. And so that might have even been my first one that I went to. Like, I was getting to know Daniel McHenry, you know, the leader.
But shout
I was
out to still, him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's really cultivated a community because, like, you know, I was, well, I'm still very shy about, you know, expressing myself authentically. You know, I came out late in life and things like that. But I remember when I saw you, just the energy around you and the way that you, like, introduced yourself to everyone. I thought, first of all, that you were born and raised Tulsa. Okay, I thought you'd been here forever. And I thought you knew everybody there, you know, because you just gave a warm, you know, it was a warm vibe and it was a welcoming vibe. And so my last question, which you kind of hinted at this, is the question that I think a lot of people in Tulsa have been grappling with when it comes to Tulsa Remote, right? How do you move authentically as someone who's not from here in a way that you are giving back to people who are not used to having resources here in Tulsa?
Yeah. And I also want to say, too, I feel like people had resources here, you know, and they were just taken away, you know? And so I'm pretty sure that when you see other programs come in, and even if they may not be quote unquote replicating that, it can still have that same feeling.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about moving authentically, for me, you know, like I said, I was born and raised in Boston, and I was born in the inner city of Boston and raised in the inner city of Boston. And I saw gentrification happen right before my eyes in Boston. And I was used to being at schools where people would come in and you didn't know them and you were trying to figure out why they were here and what they were trying to do. And they were like, we're just simply here to help. You know, we're college students at Harvard and we're just trying to help you. And I remember being turned off by that initially. But it's when you open your eyes and when you open your heart, what you realize is that we all have similarities. And there are things that we can all feel. There's things that we can all agree upon. And there's things that we can just sense. And so for me, like I shared even in our interview a few weeks ago, you know, when I come to any city, wherever I reside, the first place I want to go and what I ask myself are, where are the Black people at? Where are the people of color at? And where are the queer people? Those are my questions.
Yeah.
And what it looks like is, how do I engage in those communities how do I learn? How do I show up to their events? How do I see how they're moving? What are they doing? How are they interacting? How are they showing up? How, like, learning about their community, learning about what they like, what they don't like. And it can be really tough. I'm not going to lie. It's tough, especially when you do feel and there's like resistance.
Yeah.
And for me, I'm used to that resistance as somebody that grew up in foster care. Mm-hmm. I'm used to being in places where I've been different, where I've been the only one. So I understand. And at the same time, for me, I have always searched for a place to call home. And that's something that is not just particular to me,
right,
but it's for anybody that has not had a place to call home. And it's not even limited to people that grew up in foster care, but it's particularly important for us to find community and seek out community and be in search of community, because that's what really our hearts desire. Because when you think about it, not only have we been ripped away from our families, we've been ripped away from our siblings, we've been ripped away from our culture, we've been ripped away from our communities. Some of us have been ripped away from our schools. You know, some of us have been ripped away from our churches. And so when you go to new places, all you want to desire is to feel accepted, you know, and to be seen and to be valued, because I see you, I value you, and I want to get to know you and I want to work alongside you. And so I really think it's about having mutual respect, but just knowing that at the end of the day, all of us have experienced trauma to some degree. All of us have experienced struggle to some degree. And it's not only until we open our eyes, our hearts, our minds to be able to see that, wow, I can connect with you because I understand what loss is. I know what it's like. And I see you. And I'm here with you. And I'm with you. And so I think that if we can come to it from that perspective, especially in this upcoming year, we're going to need each other more now than ever.
You ain't lying.
You know what I'm saying? And it shouldn't matter that I'm gay. It shouldn't matter that I'm Black. It shouldn't matter that I'm a woman. You know what I'm saying? None of those things should matter. Now, what should matter is that you take those into consideration, mm-hmm. you know, to recognize the privileges that you may have. But at the same time, if we can just come together and seek community and to know that if you're doing what you're doing and then you're helping somebody else, it just goes all around. And that's really what it should be. That's really what it should be about, is us helping each other, you know? And so that's really what my hope is.
Imani Myers, author of You Are the Prize, working on a brand new app, Launch Ahead, for transitioning out of foster care. Thank you so much for being on In Depth with Dion. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Dion. And I'm going to tell you, this is a full circle moment for me, because like you said, when I saw you as well at Black Queer Tulsa, seeing you show up in who you are and everybody in that space, that means a lot. It really does. Because when you come to a place that's not fully open, that doesn't fully see you fully as you are, each of us need a safe place. And so you were a safe place. And now I get to be here in community with you in a safe place. And it's beautiful. And so thank you for all of who you are as well.
Look, I really appreciate you for that.
For real.
You're trying to give me a cry on the podcast. You got to stop it. All right, Jesse.
It's okay to cry. It's okay to cry.
For this week's Community Spotlight, I spoke with Dr. George Henderson, an Oklahoma civil rights giant who offered advice for the next generation of changemakers, disruptors, and abolitionists. Check out what he had to say.
The things that happened to the students here should never have happened to anybody at any university. They were disrespected. Slurs and racial epithets were written on the stalls of the toilet facilities at the university. Sidewalks would be chalked with racist statements. And some of the fraternities had the audacity to have plantation celebrations. They dress up as slaves and dress up as homeowners and run around their yards depicting that scene. The students fought back. They organized. And when I met the students, I understood why I was here. Good gracious. They could have gone anywhere else but here, but they wanted to be here. For their reason was, Ada Laura Scipio Fisher came here and she claimed it for us too. And they said, the us are us. And they organized. It was the first time that Black fraternities and sororities and independents, graduate students and undergraduates, all of those separate bodies came together with one organization. And Melvin B. Tolson Jr., the first African-American professor here, Lenny Marie Tolliver the second, and George Henderson the third. We agreed to be their faculty sponsors with my condition, of course, that you be nonviolent. Well, that didn't sit well with some of the students because they said, you know, Malcolm, why don't you tell us about him and why don't we do that stuff? And I said, you'll lose. You'll lose badly. Let's try it nonviolently. They did. Why did I come? I was sent here. Why did I stay? I fell in love with the students. I'm an only child. Barbara's an only child, but throughout the years we have now adopted in our own minds, in our own feelings and emotions, hundreds of other people's children, and they're our children too. That's why we stayed. The first place where students could come, Black students could come, and cook a meal was our kitchen. The first place that some of them could come and check out a couple of kids because they missed their own brothers and sisters was our children. The first place that they could come around the pit and talk about things and just be themselves was this house. So didn't have a fraternity house, but they had our house. This is a place where they got to meet because the only place they could bring their guests, like Angela Davis, Maya Angelou, I could go on and on and on. All of the guests who came to Oklahoma to speak about Black people and Black history came to our house and our children got a chance to meet them.
Thank you, Dr. Henderson, for sharing your story. It's so impactful. This week for Mic Up, I went to TikTok to learn what some Oklahomans have to say about a proposed law that would outlaw homeless shelters and other resources for the homeless in every single city of the state except Oklahoma City and Tulsa. Hear what they had to say.
A new bill is causing shockwaves across Oklahoma, with some calling it anti-homeless. The bill would only allow Oklahoma City and Tulsa to provide services and programs to their own homeless populations. If passed, cities like Lawton, right here in Southwest Oklahoma, would be forbidden from supplying those same things to their own homeless population. And this provision right here within the bill is raising a lot of eyebrows because some say it is directly targeting women's shelters. If you're wondering who proposed such a bill, well, that was Lisa Standridge, pictured right here, who is heading into her very first session within the Oklahoma legislature. Tell us, what do you think about this bill? Tell us below, right now.
February 3rd will be the first reading of this horrific bill, SB 484, in the Oklahoma Senate, which is where Lisa Standridge has introduced this bill. This bill makes it illegal for any city to help homeless populations or provide outreach. And they've included the definition of homeless to include people that would lose housing due to domestic violence. So they're specifically targeting women escaping domestic violence from being able to get help to escape it. This is just awful, 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 awful. Anyway, February 3rd, we need to show up at the Oklahoma State Capitol, wherever you are, come protest.
That's all for now. Watch In Depth with Dion on YouTube, the Black Wall Street Times, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Subscribe to In Depth with Dion on Patreon for exclusive and behind-the-scenes content. This podcast is presented by the Black Wall Street Times. Special thanks to Jesse Ulrich, our producer, and to every listener in Oklahoma and around the country.